Yes, we're back, dear listener. Episode 425 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove podcast. I'm Trevor, the Iron Fist. With me, Scott, the Velvet Glove. How are you, Scott?
Good, thanks, Trevor. G'day, Trevor. G'day, Joe. G'day, listeners. I hope everyone's well.
Joe, the tech guy, is here as well.
Evening, all.
Joe's volume is low. We're trying to fix that as we go, but we'll see how we go. Hey, Joe, maybe we're not live on Facebook. Maybe I didn't put it down as a... I might have somehow missed it as one of the...
I'll have a look, see.
...places to stream to. If you can try and fix it.
It says we have one viewer on Facebook.
Oh, okay. So it is doing it. Okay. It just looked like it wasn't coming through. Well, dear listener, news and politics, sex and religion, maybe not so much sex, I don't think, in this episode. News, international politics. I mean, everything revolves around just Gaza, international politics at the moment, I think. So what have we got for you?
The air out of everything.
Yeah. What have we got for you? We've got, my hero, Yiannis Varoufakis, effectively banned from Germany, and we'll just talk about what they are doing in Germany in their response to this whole Palestine-Gaza crisis. And then we're going to... talk a little bit about China and the Spratly Islands. Found some information about past treaties that might guide us into the ownership of the Spratly Islands. And then a bit more about sort of global hegemony and hypocrisy around Gaza, China update, US protectionism, multipolar world. We might even get onto a four-day week, which was quite interesting. Scott's going to leave us by 9. If we're still going, he'll tune out, but we'll see how we go. So what are we grateful for? I have something. Do you gentlemen have anything that you're grateful for in particular?
Yeah, getting up early in the morning and starting work every day. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Do you want to
I'm a groundskeeper at Slade Point State School at the moment, people. So I've actually finally started working. So it's only a temporary gig. Well, God, I hope it's only temporary. I'm a casual groundskeeper staff member and all that sort of stuff. So I got to start there at 6 o'clock in the morning and work until 3 in the afternoon.
Well, as you sit there in the lunchroom with your work colleagues, I hope you tell them about this podcast, Scott.
I do tell them about the podcast. Anyway.
A few more listeners. Good. Any of them tried it?
Sorry?
Have any of them listened?
I don't know. You know, I've got Lloyd down in Rockhampton to start listening. He tunes in every Monday night to have a look at us online. Right. And if he doesn't make it there on Monday night, he listens to the podcast itself.
Okay.
And I couldn't tell you about anyone from Parkrun. I don't think any of them have. So anyway.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. Joe, got anything you're grateful for?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Fair enough. I'm grateful for a support group for Trevors. Came across this article in The Sun, which is, of course, a UK paper, and it reads that a bloke fed up...
Paper's a loose term, but anyway, yes.
Okay. The Sun, a type of toilet paper with black ink printed on it, Joe, yes, in the UK. So it featured a story about a guy called Trevor, fed up with negativity over his name, has set up a support group for other Trevors. Trevor Cunningham, 66, says he wants to stop the maligned moniker being linked to geeks and nitwits. He said, "I thought if I could get Trevors from all over the world to offer their services for free to other Trevors, people would then associate the name with kindness." The once popular title, shared by the likes of England footballer Trevor Brooking and broadcaster Trevor McDonald, fell out of favour in the 1970s. This is all news to me, dear listener. It was mocked in the Ian Dury's 1977 song, Clever Trevor.
Clever Trevor, yep.
And in 2020 in the UK, just 11 tots, kids, were given the tainted term Trevor.
How many that have, 100,000 or that have more than that, wouldn't they, births a year, wouldn't they?
I don't know. Or just
that'd have to have almost a million, wouldn't it?
I don't know, but Trevor's a tainted term, according to this article. Yeah. Retired engineer Trevor of Torquay, Devon, said, "I always liked my name as a child. I thought it was posh. But by the time I was 8, I realised it was associated with nitwits. As I've got older, I've embraced it." Good on you, Trevor. "And realised the name doesn't deserve the reputation it has." Have I missed something here? Is it true? Like, is Trevor a bit of a funny name?
I've never heard of it being funny. It's just
Joe is looking a little hesitant here.
No? I was going to say, I remember Ian Dury's song, but.
Right.
Aside from that, not really. I mean, the only Trevor I'm thinking is Trevor McDonald, who's the BBC, not BBC, Channel 4, I think.
Yeah, broadcaster.
He's well respected.
I was shocked to read this article, I have to say, although I am grateful that there is a support group, which I didn't really need until now, perhaps. So, there's 126 members, apparently. And,
just be thankful you're not a Karen.
Yes, that's true. And apparently the website proves that Trevors aren't all boring or daft. Yeah. And there was a thing that a guy, Trevor Kavanagh, who was one of the Sun's top Trevors, and he said, "Until now I never realised my name made me a nerd in need of a support group. For the first time I understand what it's like to be part of a persecuted minority." There you go, Scott. You are an openly gay man living in rural Queensland, part of a persecuted minority, arguably.
I don't feel persecuted or anything like that. Yeah. See, most of my mates up here know that I'm gay and no one gives a shit.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, most of my friends know I'm called Trevor.
Exactly.
I didn't think it was a problem until now. But anyway, there we go.
Yeah, your mate Bob says that a thousand flowers bloom, doesn't he?
Yes. Who says that? Who says that?
Bob Catter.
Oh, does he? Yes. Anyway, that's it. I'm grateful for the Trevor support group that I didn't think I needed or didn't know anything about, but I'm glad it's there.
Exactly.
Mm. Now, in recent times, we've been talking about Yiannis Varoufakis more so than usual because he has that documentary, which I still haven't watched, but it is on the list, Joe, and you enjoyed it, I know. And he's been in the news in addition to that because of being banned in Germany and the German response to this whole Palestinian-Gaza issue is very interesting, I think. So first of all, we just need to deal with what actually happened to Yiannis in Germany and did he deserve it? So he wrote an article in New Statesman. And so reading his article, he says, "In the name of protecting Israel's security, the German government has sunk to farcical new authoritarian lows. As I write these lines, I am banned not only from stepping on German soil," so Yiannis Varoufakis cannot step on German soil. "Remarkably, also, he's banned from connecting via video link to any event in Germany." I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. And he says why. And on October the 8th, so the day after Hamas attacked Israel, he was in Berlin, found out about the attack from the previous day during a TV interview and was asked, "Do you condemn Hamas?" And he replied, this is on the 8th of October, "I condemn every single atrocity, whomever is the perpetrator or the victim. What I do not condemn is armed resistance to an apartheid system designed as part of a slow-burning but inexorable ethnic cleansing program. As a European, it is important to refrain from condemning either the Israelis or the Palestinians when it is us, Europeans, who have caused this never-ending tragedy. After practicing rabid anti-Semitism for centuries, leading up to the uniquely vile Holocaust, we have been complicit for decades with the slow genocide of Palestinians, as if two wrongs make one right." Gentlemen, anything in that that would warrant the banning of Yiannis Varoufakis?
No, it's quite reasonable what he said.
Yes.
You know, I suppose he could take exception to his comments of I do not condemn armed resistance to an apartheid system. Now, you could then argue whether or not Israel is an apartheid system. It clearly is apartheid. That's between us, but it hasn't actually been recognised as being an apartheid system because you do have Islamic people, you do have Palestinian people who are citizens of Israel and all that sort of thing. They've got Israeli cards and everything else. So I don't think you could actually call that a direct apartheid system there. But the way they are treating the people in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip is definitely apartheid. Mm. They are behaving so appallingly badly, I don't think there's any other word for it.
Certainly his comments are nuanced and informative and there's nothing in it that is inciting some sort of hatred or anti-Semitic viewpoint. It's quite reasonable commentary, I would have thought. Even if you disagree with some of it, you can't really give it the flavour of something so incendiary that it needs to be banned for the safety of the public.
Exactly.
So, days later, he was disinvited by Vienna's Academy of Fine Arts from delivering the prestigious Otto Wagner lecture. Then, on the 16th of February at Berlin's Babylon Theatre, was going to be the premiere of the documentary we've been talking about, and the police leaned heavily on the theatre's proprietor to cancel the event. Asked why, the authorities simply replied, "For a farkas." And, well, defiantly, the proprietor of the theatre happened to be Jewish and he told the police he wouldn't budge. So, ironic, I guess. Then he says a month ago he got an email from his publisher, who he's used for publishing books in Germany, has been with them for dozens of years and issued 6 books. And basically the publisher pulled the pin on him. And he says, as the body count in Gaza mounted, the authorities began to lash out. And he talks about the case of a colleague, Iris Heffetz. Iris is an Israeli psychoanalyst. I suppose every Israeli is a psychoanalyst, aren't they? Like if you watch enough Woody Allen movies. Anyway, Iris, an Israeli psychoanalyst, in Berlin, was arrested on charges of anti-Semitism for walking alone on the street with a placard reading, "As an Israeli and as a Jew, stop the genocide in Gaza." So he's arrested
for anti-Semitism for saying that.
A Israeli Jew with a placard saying, "As an Israeli and as a Jew, stop the genocide in Gaza." This is outrageous that Germany's doing this. Then, 12th of April, Ghazan Abu Sitter, the British Palestinian rector of the University of Glasgow, was prevented from entering Germany to join Yanis and others at the Palestine Congress. And he was deported to the UK after hours of interrogation. So there was this sort of event where they were going to talk about Palestine and Gaza and all the problems. Meanwhile, 2,500 police mobilised outside the event and harassed attendees. Imagine 2,500 police outside a Palestinian Congress. A young Jewish activist holding a placard with the words "Jews against genocide" was arrested. As he was led away, only half jokingly, he asked the policeman, "Would it have been okay if it read 'Jews support genocide'?" So the Congress started with only a fraction of the attendees who managed to get through the 2,500 police. And shortly before Yanis was about to talk to the audience, the police invaded the auditorium, grabbed the microphone, tore out the wires of the live streaming equipment. And then on Saturday the 13th, he was issued a Betatagungsverbot, which is a ban on any political activity that has been used only, and it's only been used a few times against Islamic State operatives. So he was banned from any political activity. And then that, after a couple of days with his lawyers harassing the government, that was replaced with an Einreiseverbot, a softer entry ban. To this day, the German authorities have refused his request for a written statement on their rationale. So, so he says it's clear that it's not about protecting Jews. It's about protecting the right of Israel to commit any war crime of its choice. And he said it's a sad reflection of the waning economic power that is embracing an increasingly farcical authoritarianism. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? A guy like Yanis, and those stories of just Israeli Jew sympathisers being arrested.
It makes me wonder whether or not Germany is actually trampling on freedom of speech. And that's the stuff. They certainly seem to be trampling on freedom of expression, don't they?
Well, they've always had anti-Nazi laws. Whether they're trying to this. But the optics of German police arresting a Jew.
Yeah, I know. That's got to make them, sure, that's got to make them shudder.
Mm. Yeah, you'd hope so.
Yeah.
So I was listening to a podcast with Yanis talking to Naomi Klein, and there is a little clip from this which is a really interesting take on what's happening here with Germany. And just bringing it up now, so I'll play this and have a listen to this.
All of these Western powers lining up, you know, for Israel, including Germany, saying, you know, whatever the result, we stand with Israel. And then Namibia steps forward and says, excuse me, you know, Germany, it's just because you've committed genocide several times doesn't make you the arbiter of what is genocide.
It seems to me that in Germany these days, you can only mention genocide if you are supporting it.
You're a teacher. What do we want from students? We want them to be able to think critically, to recognize patterns, not just to memorize, you know, like a rule, don't be mean to Jews. No, that's not the lesson. The lesson is don't practice othering. Don't create an in-group and an out-group. This is why I always say Germany is a terrible student, because they learned a rule, but they didn't learn a principle. So now they're like, okay, well, the rule is stand with Israel, but we're going to transfer all of these similar sort of patterns of thought and project them onto Muslims and Palestinians and immigrants.
You know, even within our own movement, Naomi, it was very difficult to make the arguments that you're making.
I thought that was very good. I really like that. So what she said there was, Germany is a terrible student. Germany learned a rule but not a principle. They learnt, don't be mean to Jews, but they missed the concept, which is don't practice othering.
Yeah, I mean, this is very much... do as I do, don't do as I say. It's as a parent bringing up a child, it was very much, I didn't want to give my daughter rules that she had to obey. I wanted her to understand principles of not being mean to other people, so that she didn't just blindly follow a rule. She had the tools to make up her own mind as to what was right and what was wrong.
You know, it's the thing about this Gaza atrocity just dragging on the way it has, and now that the...
Scott,
can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I bumped the microphone, I'm sorry. The Gaza atrocity dragging on as long as it has, it means that the Israeli soldiers have lost all discipline, that they are just, you know, like that... That footage you were talking about last week on the podcast, you were saying that the Jewish soldiers were shooting those Palestinians that were crawling away from them.
Mm.
you know, that is very reminiscent of the when the SS cracked down on the Jewish uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. They called them parachutists or balloonists or something like that. It was, they'd set fire to the lower levels of the building, and the fire just moved throughout the whole building. So they'd then throw a mattress down and they'd jump out of the windows. And they'd say that the SS soldiers had developed a game, and that was who could get the most number of shots in before the body hit the ground. You know, it's that sort of thing that it certainly sounds like the Israelis have developed that type of thing now that they see a Palestinian, they just want to pick them off, you know.
Yeah, I'll get onto that in a bit later in the podcast, but I'm just going to circle back here to this idea that Germany is a terrible student, that they learnt this rule but not the principle.
Mm.
And, dear listener, if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you will understand that the lawyer in me, and this happened a lot with the 12th Man as well, is, you know, he would say certain things about freedom of speech, or, you know, we were arguing about bakeries and their right to refuse service to different people. And what we were examining in all those arguments was, I would try and say, well, if the circumstances are different in this way, what's your answer? And if the circumstances are different in another way, what's your answer? And it was all about trying to come to a set of principles, a statement of principle that you could then apply in a multiple range of situations. That's when you've got an ethical principle in place that's robust, and the less number of exceptions, the better. And, you know, that comes from doing law, where invariably, whether in criminal law or tort law or other things, you're exposed to this idea of for certain things to either be a crime or to be a tort, here are the elements of the offence. Here are the elements of the action, A, B, C, D, E. Can you find those elements? If so, then you've got whatever the section's applying to. And it's a way of thinking that is about being systematic and having concepts that go beyond just one set of facts and can be applied to multiple set of facts. So I just find that an exact what you've talked about there, Naomi Klein, is right, that the Germans haven't understood that the problem wasn't, the lesson was not that you should not be mean to Jews. It was that you should not practice othering and having in-groups and out-groups. That was the lesson. And you apply that to the situation with the Jews, but then you apply it to any other races or any other type of difference that arises in our community. And, dear listener, that's what happened with the voice debate. And my argument was that people were feeling sorry for Indigenous people and took the lesson to be, don't be mean to Indigenous people, where in fact the lesson from history was, don't be a racist. And people missed that in Australia and committed the same mistake that Germany is making right now, where people here in Australia went, well, whatever the case, we just must be, make sure we're not mean to Indigenous people. And they missed the underlying principle of treating people equally and without a racial difference. So there we go. That was my take on the Yiannis Varoufakis matter. Anybody want to dispute that? Nope, all good. Yeah, okay. Now, just on Guy Rundle was writing in Crikey. Mm-hmm. Dear listener, I quite enjoy the Crikey articles. I don't always agree with them. I really enjoy Guy Rundle's writing. He's very verbose and uses words that you just don't know the meaning of, but you kind of suspect what he's saying. And anyway, he wrote about Penny Wong's statement this week suggesting Australia might join a UN unilateral declaration of Palestinian statehood is the surest sign yet that Labor has started to pay attention to the potential electoral fallout as a direct result of its position on Gaza. So then his article goes on to really say that Labor has taken for granted ethnic minorities as being part of their voting base and hasn't felt that it needs to do anything to keep them happy, and in fact can do things that will make them unhappy, but they're hardly likely to switch to the Greens because culturally too different. And he's saying that things are changing and that, in fact, within the Labor Party, that's a new faction that's kind of based on ethnic minorities. And he also, what else did he say, that they're starting to see, for example, Greens leader Sam Ratnam has announced that he's going to try for the federal seat of Wills, currently held by Labor. And that a guy like that would not be doing a run like that if he didn't think he had a chance. And so so he's suggesting that Labor has ignored, say, Palestinian, Middle Eastern constituents, and that they're starting to find that maybe that's politically dangerous. He sort of describes Albanese's faction as being in bed with the right-wing faction, who, of course, are very pro-USA, pro-defence, very, you know, the right-wing of the Labor Party, Richard Marles and his group, they're closer to the Liberals than they are to what most people would have thought as, say, the left wing of the Labor Party. These guys are pretty hot conservatives on a lot of this stuff. What did he say here? He said it's about mounting a basic resistance to a government and party that pulled a swift one. Surprising to even the most jaded and cynical progressive, substituting, post-election, a war party for a social democrat one. I think that's right. They've spent a lot of time, this podcast, we've spent a lot of time talking about, you know, previously, Scott, we spent a lot of time talking about submarines when nobody was talking about submarines. But we're spending a lot of time talking about China and defence and America and all the rest of it when I think this current Labor government is talking a lot of that stuff. Yeah. So it seems to me. Yeah. And then Bernard Keane writes an article basically describing Richard Marles as Australia's worst minister because and the Department of Defence has been recently given an extra $10 billion a year in spending. So it's going to increase from 2% of GDP to 2.4% of GDP. And he says, so Richard Marles, Defence Minister and Deputy PM, was talking at a press club, National Press Club, and he said the Liberals were one of the worst defence governments in our nation's history in a time when Australia could least afford it. And as Bernard Keane in Crikey says, when Marles complains about the coalition being in and out of a submarine deal with Japan and then in and out of a submarine deal with France, he, Marles, neglects to mention that Labor supported both of those decisions. So how can Marles complain about that when it was bipartisan? And he goes on to say, this is the interesting part, as Bernard Keane and Crikey, in fact, the best decision made in defence procurement in recent decades was Tony Abbott's decision to buy off-the-shelf conventional submarines from the Japanese. And that's one that Labor strongly opposed and which was eventually overturned by Abbott's own party in a desperate bid to save the careers of South Australian MPs. So I wasn't aware of that.
Why was Labor opposed to that? Is it because they weren't going to manufacture them over here?
I guess so. I suspect that's the case. But I wasn't aware of that until now. So
it's always a vote winner, isn't it?
Yeah, jobs for South Australians. So,
well, jobs for onshore.
Yeah, yep. So there we go. There's a little trivia point that we knew about Tony Abbott wanting to get the Japanese off-the-shelf subs. Wasn't aware that it was Labor opposed that. So, yeah. And he just finishes off by calling Miles a dullard and Labor hack, elevated to high office purely by his geographical origin and factional allegiance. And I reckon that is all true, and that he's just captive to the defence force and is basically just like a little puppet doing what they tell him to do. So, Joe, did you put something up on the screen? I missed it. It was a quote or something?
Yeah. Oh. It was John saying, "I couldn't agree more. Some of the stuff I've learned since joining the party would surprise you."
Right. There we go. John, of course, our resident Labor Party man or member. Yeah. Well, what does China say about all this? China says they've slammed the plans by the federal government to spend extra dollars on defence, and they've urged Australia to abandon the Cold War mentality, which we are in. And, quote, the Chinese said, "We hope Australia will correctly view China's development and strategic intentions, abandon the Cold War mentality, do more things to keep the region peaceful and stable, and stop buzzing about China." That's what the Chinese have to say. They must just look at us and laugh. In fact, the other thing in this was the defence strategy that Miles announced includes a push to widen the recruitment eligibility criteria. And they're looking, Scott, at allowing defence to recruit non-Australian citizens. What do you think of the idea of non-Australian citizens being recruited into our Australian Defence Force?
I don't know. Well, we've got to think about that because it's one of those things you've never had to do that before.
Mm.
So, you know, is it a fast track to them getting residency here or not?
That's how it's promoted in the US when they have allowed
non-citizens to join their army, is that they do their 5 years and that sort of stuff, they get out and become citizens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, non-citizens in that case is people who are second generation but in the not US? Citizens. Yeah. So they came over as children generally, isn't it?
That's sort of undocumented second generation. Yeah.
So it's not recruiting people from overseas to join.
No, but I'm just wondering.
It's people who've grown up in the country and are being recruited in. So they're in Americans in name, or sorry, in spirit. It's not going around the world.
I've met a guy here that's Vietnamese, and he's over here and he's on the working visa and that sort of stuff. And he came up here because that was a regional area, and if you'd spend time in the regional area, you'd get an extension to your working visa. Now, he's almost run out of that, and he wanted to apply to go into university, but they've actually started to crack down on that as a way to getting here permanent residency, is getting through university and that sort of stuff, and then you graduate and you end up leaving with a degree and you also end up leaving with PR. But they've cracked down on that, so he's looking about heading home now. So.
Mm.
I was just wondering if he could join the army for 5 years, well, that would be a way to him get residency.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Joe, so we don't really have a large population of people who have been here since birth who would fill that same sort of role of being Australian, sort of born and bred but non-citizen, who could be encouraged to fight as a means of getting citizenship. Like, it's a pretty crummy way of.
So do you recruit overseas? I mean, I did meet somebody.
I think they've got to explain to us exactly what they're talking about before we can actually, because we're just making suppositions here because we just don't know. Are they going to go over to Malaysia and Thailand and that sort of stuff and say, "You want to become an Australian citizen, you're just going to go and join the army for 5 years. yeah, okay, but you know, we've got to make sure you can speak English and all that sort of stuff first.
I've met British soldiers who've been recruited, fast-tracked out, because it's deemed a friendly nation. But yeah, where, how do you go for recruiting? And then there was the big thing in the UK about former Gurkhas who were not given citizenship, having served in the army.
And that was really bloody cruel, actually.
I think Miles might be thinking of New Zealanders.
Yeah, possibly.
Well, he might be thinking of New Zealanders and all that sort of stuff, but you know,
they're close enough. I mean, we're always, you know, claiming New Zealanders as Aussies when it suits us.
Mm.
But, you know, so this would just be another example of it.
I'm not opposed to it at all, but I think they've got to actually explain what they're actually talking about.
If we can't rustle up enough people who want to defend the country, then that's our problem.
I don't really have a problem if we're going to import people and all that sort of stuff to fill out the ranks of the army.
Joel in the chat room says there are plenty of Australian army guys that struggle to speak English, especially when they're at the pub.
Yeah, I suppose that's very true, Joel. You know, it's very true. When they're at the pub, they don't speak English. They speak bullshit. Mm. You know, it's one of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, and also in amongst all that, Miles was saying that China has employed coercive tactics in pursuit of its strategic objectives. What do you think he'd be thinking about there, Scott?
I'm not sure. I mean, when they're accused of so many coercive tactics and all that sort of stuff, I couldn't tell you what the hell he's talking about.
I think he's thinking of the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea.
Yeah, I understand that.
And the way that China has been building fortifications.
Infrastructure?
Yes, on the various rocks and adding sand and soil to create ports and whatnot. So I think that's what he's talking about. And we spent some time in this podcast, Scott, years ago, talking about international maritime law and economic zones and, you know, if a rock only appeared at low tide, whether that enabled you to create an economic zone around it or not. You remember that?
Very vaguely, yeah.
Anyway, came across this thing, which was by a lawyer professor, an Irish professor of international law, Anthony Carty. And so he's an Irish professor of international law. He's now a visiting professor at the Institute of Humanities and Social Sciences at Peking University and a professor at the School of Law of Beijing Institute of Technology. And he has delved into the history of the treaties surrounding the Philippines with Spain and the USA, and also the views of the UK and France in relation to the Spratly Islands and who actually owns them. And so he's basically looked through diplomatic archives and cabinet papers of the UK and French governments over the last century to see, well, what were these people saying about the Spratly Islands way back when? And he comes to the conclusion that, in fact, the UK and France, its senior diplomats, its government, cabinet papers and whatnot, are basically pretty clear in saying that the Spratly Islands belong to China and that and also acknowledging that the USA has been encouraging Vietnam and the Philippines to sort of make claim on these islands simply for shit-stirring and causing problems. So that's a sort of a summary of what he found in the article. And there's various quotes I won't go into, but the really interesting one as part of all this was that you may recall that America and Spain have had their difficulties over the years, especially early on. And there was a Treaty of Paris, 1898, and that was the one where Spain relinquished its empire to the US, especially Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. So that's when Spain said, okay, we give up. You can have this territory. And the US gave them $20 million. And that was all signed in 1898. And then, much later on, in 1946, the US relinquished sovereignty over the Philippines. And in doing so, the Treaty of Manila in 1946 referred to the Treaty of Paris, 1898, when speaking about, well, what territory are we talking about when we're talking about the Philippines? And in that Treaty of Paris, the one where Spain gave up the Philippines, which was then used by the US when it gave up the Philippines, it's really clear the definition of Filipino territory excludes the Spratly Islands because they're located beyond the 118th meridian of longitude east of Greenwich. And the sort of the treaty documents are quite clear that that territory is not included in the definition of the Philippines at that time. So I find that quite interesting. Yeah. And this guy has written a book which is currently in Chinese and there's an English language version coming out. I'm going to get a copy when it comes out, provided it's not exorbitant, and tell you more of the details. So
you're saying somebody employed by the Chinese government has found in favour of the Chinese government? I'm shocked. Yeah,
exactly. And that's why I quoted his credentials. But when he can actually draw on the treaty documents of 1898 and of 1946 and point to the definition of the Philippines that was used in those documents, which clearly excludes the Spratly Islands, then you have to go, okay, well, maybe he's biased in favour of the Chinese government, but it's still a compelling argument. Yeah. Like, he hasn't made up the treaty, it's there.
That is very compelling. Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
And he's got sort of documents retrieved from the archives from various people, ambassadors and others, basically saying it's Chinese. So, you know, this is where if the source material matches up with the argument, then it doesn't really matter what his sort of bias might be. I find it quite interesting. So anyway, dear listener, if you're in the if you're a patron, you get the show notes with all the detail about that. Yeah. Iran and China. Ben Norton, John Simmons says, doesn't matter who paid for the research if it can be fact-checked. There we go. So we've got the US illegally imposed unilateral sanctions on China in violation of international law. Unilateral sanctions on Iran in violation of international law. China is legally trading with Iran, which it's entitled to do. And the US Congress has just voted to sanction China for violating the illegal US unilateral sanctions. So the US has told Iran, you're not allowed to sell oil. There's no international agreement on this. It's just the US saying it, which is illegal. And because China's buying the oil, the US has decided to sanction China as a secondary item. So they just do what they want when it's theirs. Do you guys spend any time on Twitter?
Nope.
Very little.
Mm.
It's called the hell in a handbasket recently, hasn't it?
I think everybody should get on Twitter and just look at what is going on in Gaza and the images of these children and their poor parents who are just cradling these dead and dying children, it just breaks your heart. And it should be on the first 10 minutes of every news program in this country, but it doesn't. And they're just the most tragic scenes of people just having their final cuddle with their dead kid. Or the kid is mangled and begging their parents for help and their parents can't do anything about it. Or a kid wakes up and the legs are missing and says, "I want my legs back." And just the most heartbreaking stuff that we just don't see in regular media. And it's all there on Twitter. So for all of the terrible things about Elon Musk and the way he's running Twitter and whatnot, it is still a space where these sorts of things are shown. Mm. And people need to see them to be reminded of just the cruelty that is going on in that country. It just beggars belief that we're all just sitting around with our first world problems, and upwards of 30,000 people are just being systematically wiped off the planet, and a lot of them are just kids, and it's so cruel what's going on. And I think, dear listener, you should get onto Twitter and just start looking around and reminding yourself of the cruelty that is going on there. So that's my recommendation, rather than me showing it all to you. Maybe I will in another episode. I don't know.
Sorry?
Maybe I will grab – I've got a bunch of the clips. Maybe I will, just to save everybody the trouble. Maybe next week. And it's horrendous, horrendous. But we need to see it to remind ourselves of the cruelty that's going on there. Fortunately, though, apparently the US has not violated human rights. According to the US, sorry, Israel has not violated any human rights. Here we go. Just listen to one of these spokesmen.
And to date, as you and I are speaking, they have not found any incidents where the Israelis have violated international humanitarian law. And lest you think we don't take it seriously, I can assure you that we do. We look at this in real time.
They have never violated international humanitarian law ever in the past 5 to 6 months.
I'm telling you, the State Department has looked at incidents in the past and has yet to determine that any of those incidents violate international humanitarian law.
Yeah, we just can't take, these people seriously. Why are we listening? Why are we allies with these people?
Oh, that makes absolutely no sense at all.
Well, it does if you're just trying to cover up because you don't care. Yeah. There we go. According to the US, Israel's not violated. Well, they wouldn't be able to sell them arms, Scott.
Yeah, I know.
If they're violating international law.
You know, there is one country in the world that could stop this. That's Israel. And there's a second country in the world that could stop this. This is the United States. All the United States actually has to say to Benjamin Netanyahu, pull your troops back now.
Mm.
And then they're going to fuck around for a couple of days. And then after that, Joe Biden's just got to do exactly what George W. said. Well, for the last time that Israel incurred either the West Bank or Gaza, whatever it was, he said, "I meant what I said, withdraw without delay." And they did. They did pack up and move out.
The or else is we're just going to stop supplying you with money and materials. Like exactly. They just can't keep waging this sort of battle without the US arming them. So.
Ooh.
Joe, you sent me a message about the Dan Snow podcast about Zionism, and I started it, but I haven't finished it.
Okay.
And you said you learnt things about Zionism that you hadn't learnt before.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was stuff I'd heard before, but particularly what I'd forgotten was the background of the late 19th century Europe was a nationalism. So historically, Europe had been major empires and a melting pot. The empires had all been melting pots of nationalities. And suddenly in the 19th century, you have Italy becoming a country, Germany becoming a country, and a wave of nationalism that people wanted their own country depending on their background. And suddenly the Jews who had moved to Poland effectively in the Austro-Hungarian Empire were suddenly finding themselves having historically been considered as much citizens as anyone else, as being treated differently. And so they said, look, the only way we're going to stop this anti-Semitism is to have a country of our own. Yeah, we're being treated differently, not because of our religion, because these were secular Jews, but because of our ancestry, because we're different. And so we need a place. If the Germans are going to have a Germany and if the English are going to have an England, then we Jews need a country of our own. And so this was the beginning of Zionism. And I forget, they were talking about, there were 30 or 40 different places that were proposed. So the number of places that were proposed, I think the big sticking point was this whole them wedded on the fact that Palestine was the historical home and it was given to them by God. And this is where all the trouble arises. Whether we could have found somewhere else that would have been a good place for them. But yeah, interesting. And they also, so that was an Irish professor talking on another, that. But there's also
another Irish professor, was it?
Yeah. I mean, he's University of Oxford. But yes, he was an Irishman. And then somebody talking about the Galveston movement, where apparently lots of Jews were immigrating out of Eastern Europe to the US. And there was concern about large numbers of Jews migrating to New York causing anti-Semitism. And so they were all brought into Galveston, Texas, rather than into New York, and then dispersed into the hinterland of the US. Which is why there are a lot of Jews spread out across the US, because literally they said, we don't want an enclave. We don't want we want them integrated into society. America is a new country. So that was quite interesting about the history of the Jews in the US.
So anyway, that was the Dan Snow podcast, and I had a flick through some of the episodes and might be some worthwhile stuff on there. So check that out. Scott, we've got you for 3 more minutes. Bearing that in mind, Scott, what else do I want to quickly get in here before we finish up?
Pro-Putin stuff.
What's that?
There better not be any pro-Putin stuff in this
thing. How about just a mention, because we're talking about how we're moving to a multipolar world now and the loss of US hegemony, and I sort of reading something and it just reminded me that because what we've got now is, you know, the Ukraine has lost to Russia, we've got Iran seizing US ships, we've got Yemen winning in terms of its activities in the Red Sea, enough that the French basically had to pull their navy out, or their navy vessel, and the commander was saying, I've never seen anything like it. This was tough stuff, and we've run out of ammunition fighting the Yemens. So we've got Iran bombing Israel in retaliation for the Damascus incident, and sort of the US having to say to Iran, please don't bomb Israel, and, you know, or if you do, don't bomb them too much, and trying to find face-saving ways for that to be, you know, done.
I don't think the Iranian attack on Israel could be considered all that successful. You know, the dome did work as it was expected to, and that sort of stuff. It did actually keep out most of the arsenal.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
But part of the argument is that Iran was just doing it
as a face-saving measure. They're trying to save face because they had their
because their population would say, "What do you mean our consulate's been bombed? You're not going to do anything." So
exactly, yeah. So they had to do something.
Yeah, and they were warning everybody, you know, "We're going to do it." So that's why all of the advices were coming through in the days beforehand. For God's sake, don't go to these places.
Yeah.
You know why the embassy was bombed, though?
Presumably to kill some high-ranking Iranian officials.
But why those officials in particular?
Because they were enemies of Israel?
They were apparently the planners behind, and they provided the logistics behind the attacks in the first place, the attacks from Gaza. So that's Israel's excuse as to why they bombed the embassy.
According to who?
I think because they were the head of the Iranian Republican Guards.
Yeah, and so it sounds like it's probably Israel who have said these guys were the guys.
So I think it is.
At this point, I can't believe a word the Israeli Defense Force says about anything.
I think there's a fair recognition that Iran is funding
Hamas and Hezbollah.
Well, but didn't you just say that they bombed them because these are the guys who were responsible for planning the attack or something? Is that what you just said? Or not?
Yeah. Well, so
that part of it, I think that's just supposition. Well, that's just a statement by the Israelis.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But that's their reason for bombing it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't out of thin air, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Now I don't think bombing an embassy is the answer, but
yeah,
it's not like it was just some random thing.
I think the whole point of the attack on the Iranian embassy was to try and get the Iranians to hit back so that that would actually drag the Yanks into a war with Iran.
Sorry, say that again.
I think the whole point behind the attack on the Iranian embassy was to get the Iranians to hit back, and they were hoping they'd hit back harder than what they did so that would drag the Yanks into a war with Iran.
Maybe. Don't know. But anyway, this sort of idea that now these minor countries are sort of conducting things and the US is losing its power to stop, you know, to throw its weight around. And it's a little bit reminiscent of the Suez crisis. So with the Suez Canal, Britain, France and Israel respond to the nationalisation of the Suez Canal Company by the Egyptian President Nasser, and they used a military operation. This was back in 1956. But the landing received international condemnation. Under intense pressure, particularly from the US, troops were rapidly withdrawn and replaced by a UN force. Britain's declining status was highlighted. Its Prime Minister Anthony Eden resigned. Egypt got ownership and sovereignty of the Suez Canal. So it started off with Britain throwing its weight around and trying to prove that it was still a force in the world, and it ended up being sort of a defining moment where sort of signalled the loss of Britain as a preeminent force, confirmed that it's lower status, that it couldn't do things that it wanted to do, and it was a sort of a second-tier world power. So, yeah, just events of recent times leading to a more multipolar world are sort of demonstrating a similar thing where the US is losing control of areas that it might have thought it had control. That's my thesis. There we go. So
I don't think you're wrong about that. I think that we are in the very early stages of watching America decline. Yeah, it's whether or not China actually wants to step up and become the world number one power or whether it wants to remain at number two.
Mm. Interestingly, it was a PR disaster for Britain that Suez.
Oh, it was, yeah.
Yep. Name the country that supported Britain.
France.
France and Israel.
Sorry, besides those.
We couldn't do. Probably Australia.
Yeah, spot on, Scott. Yes. Of course we did.
Yeah, because, you know, that was Bob Menzies and all that sort of stuff. He was as British to his bootstraps, you know.
Mm. Well, but also it's the major trade route between the UK and Australia. Was through
yeah,
the
I know, but, you know, yeah, it's... Yeah,
but if the Egyptians owned it, it was still going to be the major trade route. It was just the money was going to go to someone else.
The money was going to go to the Egyptian government rather than the companies that owned and operated the canal. Mm. Now, you know, the canal was how old by then?
I don't know.
It was probably at least 100 years old, wasn't it? So they would have paid for it. They would have paid for it and all that sort of stuff. So I was thinking to myself, Britain never accepted the fact that they never really lost control of Egypt. You know, they always wanted Egypt as one of their own colonies and all that sort of stuff, but they never accepted that they never really had control of it in the first place.
Mm. Yeah.
Was the concern that Nasser would shut out countries that weren't friendly to Egypt?
Yeah, there was probably that concern too, but, you know, yeah. Well, money talks and bullshit walks. So, you know, if you can control the flow of traffic through that canal, that's what's going to generate the income for them and all that sort of stuff. And they're just going to work out which side their bread's buttered on. Are they going to actually block supply of oil going to Britain and France or anything like that, or are they actually going to allow it to go through? Mm. I think to myself, they're going to allow it to go through because it's where the money's coming from.
Mm. Anyway, well, Scott. It's your bedtime.
And, bedtime.
And that's enough. I've got stuff we can use for next week. So good on you in the chat room. Looks like you've been busily making comments there. Thank you for that. We'll be back next week with another episode. Bye for now.
And it's a good night from me.
And it's a good night from him.
Good night.